Welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. Today we'll look at a couple of subjects in the news. We'll begin in a moment and talk to a 25-year veteran of the national security community about the quality of Secretary of State Powell's presentation last week to the United Nations, which apparently has gone down well in the United States, but been greeted with a great deal of skepticism abroad. We'll be talking about both the so-called evidence that was presented and the ability of the inspectors to find anything, given what they have to work with. And then also discuss the new French-German plan that includes apparently sending thousands of inspectors along with helicopters and more modern and pervasive surveillance equipment. And we'll also talk with Roger Morris, who served on the National Security Council under Presidents Johnson and Nixon. He wrote a number of biographies on Richard Nixon and a scathing biography on Bill Clinton, the Clintons and their America, and is now just finishing a book on the history of U.S. involvement in Afghanistan and to some extent Pakistan. And just today, Pakistan and India withdrew delegations of diplomats in a situation that indicates that, along with Iraq and North Korea, tensions still exist between India and Pakistan, two nuclear-armed states with large armies deployed facing each other across a shaky truce line. And we're hoping also to talk with some engineers and scientists here in the UCLA and at Caltech, who wrote to me as a result of the interview I did last week on the hydrogen initiative on the part of President Bush in his State of Union address, talking about some of the options involving hydrogen, including direct hydrogen, burning hydrogen in the internal combustion engine, as opposed to waiting for 20 years for the fuel cells to develop. And we hopefully will be able to talk about some of the hidden obstacles in what's called H2ICE, and also in creating an infrastructure to serve the hydrogen cars. I'm speaking with Robert David Steele, who is a 25-year veteran of the national security community. He was one of the first case officers assigned to counterterrorism. He's the author of a couple of books, a new book on intelligence spies and secrecy in an open world, and The New Craft of Intelligence, Personal, Public, and Political. And what did you, as an intelligence professional, what did you think of Colin Powell's presentation?
I think Colin Powell is one of the most honorable, capable men we have, and he diminished and disgraced himself by going in with information which turned out to be plagiarized, based on open sources, and including artistic Pentagon drawings rather than actual images. It was, in short, not representative of the real classified information that we do have available, because there are grounds for concern. It was a cocky, arrogant American attempt to bamboozle the United Nations with information that subsequently turned out to be severely flawed and has been exposed around the world.
And yet it seems to have played pretty well here at home, not abroad, but here at home. And I guess, in a way, isn't that George W. Bush's target audience? He doesn't seem to care much about what the rest of the world thinks.
Well, that's precisely right. But the American audience had better care about what the rest of the world thinks, because we are at the peak of our powers and declining. We did a number of headlines in the last 2 days that are severely critical.
Could you explain who we are?
OSS.net. www.oss.net. We do headlines every day on national, military, law enforcement, and business intelligence. And our headlines have been severely critical, in part because it's been revealed in England that the so-called highly classified British intelligence report was, in fact, plagiarizing open sources done years ago by a 27-year-old graduate student at the Monterey Institute of International Studies. They plagiarized from a Jane's publication. The Pentagon depiction of the Iraqi airplane spraying anthrax was in fact a fantasy drawing by a Pentagon artist. This is low-level baloney. This is Bush League, and the pun is intended.
Well, then why, as you said, if they do have better the goods, why didn't they deliver? Is it that old argument in the intelligence community about not exposing sources and methods?
Well, the intelligence community is actually being very honest and has a very high degree of integrity. I think it's the policy elements at the very top that are subverting America's prestige in the world. On the one hand, we do have very valid classified intelligence that justifies a concern in the mid and long term. We have nothing, I repeat, we have nothing that justifies Iraq as an imminent threat. And I was very pleased to see John McLaughlin agree with that on the TV today. The second part of the problem we have is that we can't hang on to it. This stuff keeps moving around, and the American intelligence system is not optimized for staying on top of it. We really do have to have, as the French and the Germans are suggesting, U-2s, helicopters, and other measures for enforcing not only a no-fly zone, but a no-drive zone. But the third problem we have is that we seem to treat the rest of the world as if they're stupid. And so we're not going into partnership with them to actually create multinational intelligence that everyone can agree is valid and that everyone can agree is actionable. So I believe that not only has the Bush administration not made the case on Iraq, but they're about to start World War III. India and Pakistan, as you point out, are going at it. They've raised their conflict in Nepal and Bangladesh. The Pakistani service is rearming and re-energizing the Taliban for a war in Afghanistan. I believe that if Pakistan and India attack each other in any way, shape, or form, the mobs, rather than the armies, will immediately begin to go at it in terms of ethnic cleansing. We have issues in Central Asia with Turkmenistan disintegrating. I believe Iraq will ignite the now secular Indonesian, Philippine, and Malaysian Muslims who are not Arabs. Colombia is starting to heat up. And last and perhaps most importantly, the home front is undefended. Steve Emerson has a great new book out, American Jihad, The Terrorists Living Among Us. And he has a map at that book that documents 54 different terrorist cells in over 30 cities. And each of these cities I've listed, and I've put up a map on my website, OSS.net. The bottom line is we've got roughly 54 separate, distinct, militant Islamic groups with suicidal members, all of them ready to go. We've got Pakistanis fleeing the United States, literally lining up at the Canadian border trying to get out of town because they've heard that the militant Islamic Pakistanis are about to explode in the United States and they don't want to get swept up and incarcerated without a lawyer. They're literally terrified. And just to give you a final note, an example of what a Pakistani cell looks like, in Naples, Italy last week, the Italians caught 28 Pakistanis in one apartment with 100 cell phones, false documents, maps of NATO and U.S. locations, and enough explosives to blow up a three-story building. There are thousands of those cells all over the world, and most of them are in the United States of America.
But in terms of this, obviously the war on terror, or the global war on terrorism, the so-called GWAT, has taken a back seat to, terrible term, but it's what they call it in the Pentagon, it's taken a back seat to this war in Iraq. And it seems to me that for $38 billion the U.S. taxpayer has given to the Homeland Security, the new cabinet position and led by Tom Ridge.
Ian, it's much worse than that.
I mean, all that I can understand that they've done so far has made life inconvenient for Americans at airports and given us a color code.
It's much worse than that. We've wasted a year and 3 months. Senator Graham, who I think would be a much better president than George Bush, Senator Shelby, a number of U.S. senators have made the point that the president has failed to honor his first two promises to America after 9/11. The first one was bin Laden dead or alive. He hasn't done that. The second one was with us or against us. He hasn't done that either. Pakistan and Saudi Arabia have literally been allowed to get away with murder in the last year and 3 months. America is not safer. In fact, what Americans don't realize is that most of the money that was promised to the governors across the land by the Homeland Security Act has, in fact, vanished. It's not being delivered.
Well, it's also, it turns out that in terms of the Saudi cooperation, the Saudis have just apparently spirited out one of their nationals, a wife of
some. Yeah, let me be blunt here. As far as I'm concerned, the single greatest threat to America right now is Saudi Arabia and Pakistan together. Pakistan, because its intelligence service is actively aiding and abetting terrorists, including bin Laden's lieutenants who are getting in and out of Pakistan on commercial airlines, unbeknownst to the United States, evidently. And Saudi Arabia is continuing to fund terrorism, including terrorism in the United States. I mean, the American people are being seriously misled by this president and this administration, and I'm just appalled that, among other things, American TV and radio stations are refusing ads from honest, loyal, patriotic Americans who are trying to share information. I mean, thank goodness for the Internet. Otherwise, Americans would be completely in the dark.
But in terms of Pakistan, I thought that the problem there was that, at least for this administration, was that their whole geopolitical construct in that part of the world, it's basically hanging by a thread in terms of Musharraf. He's it. And if they go to war against Iraq, which will be perceived as a U.S.-Israeli war and an inevitable victory, I mean, nobody disputes that America can beat Iraq. However, I understand that the real problem is that all of these governments are likely to face regime change from their angry street.
Ian, you raise a very important point. The bottom line is the United States of America has no strategy. Has not done its homework. It appears to be focusing on short-term tactical victories, and the American people are being kept in the dark about both the long-term economic cost of all of this. We are literally going to implode our economy over Iraq, over a misguided presidential policy. We also have no strategy for the long term. I am in agreement with the Secretary General of the United Nations and with the governments of France, Germany, China, and Russia when they say that how we do Iraq and when we do Iraq matters a great deal more than allowing the United States to simply do Iraq as a tactical death run.
Well, why is it then that nobody seems to be pointing out some of these contradictions in what the president is saying, particularly when he says, for example, subsequent to his State of the Union, that Iraq has chemical weapons because intelligence has told him that the Iraqis have pre-delegated launch authority up and down the chain of command.
Well, you know, so, first off, America gave Iraq a great many of the precursors for the chemical, biochemical weapons it has. So let's not kid ourselves. We turned a blind eye to biochemicals when it suited us to go against Iran. But I'm even more concerned by a point you raised, which is why aren't people basically bearding the president? This morning I watched a number of people on talk shows, including Condi Rice and Madeleine Albright and General Schwarzkopf, and I was absolutely stunned that none of the press interviewers and none of the people brought up the fact that it's been demonstrated that a substantial portion of Colin Powell's testimony before the United Nations was based on plagiarized, dated, open sources. I mean, how is it possible that this has not become an issue in America? Well, I'll tell you why. I think the media and the political players have all become chicken. These are the same people that didn't make an issue of the fact that George Bush's brother Jeb disenfranchised 50,000 predominantly black and Democratic voters in Florida in order to steal the election in Florida for his brother. That's a crime. That should be part of a congressional hearing. It should be part of a change in the law to make sure it never happens again. So from my point of view, Americans are not yet paying attention. They don't realize that the president of the United States has basically, and not just this president, but previous presidents as well, have essentially disenfranchised America. We are being taken to a war without a congressional vote, without the American public having a serious debate. In fact, dissent has been called unpatriotic, which is in itself treason to the ideals of the Constitution. So I think we have a pretty mess here, and I'm very serious. One of my headlines today, in fact, the second headline, which talks about the six-front war, details all of the elements that are there that could put us into World War III, which I think is a 60% probability today, and I think it's going to go up to 80% within the next 2 weeks. I'm serious. I'm talking World War III with six fronts.
Well, let me just go. I'll go through those six fronts with you. But I would think though that there's nothing will happen in Iraq for at least 3 weeks because of the pilgrimage, the Hajj to Mecca. Then even the Bush administration is not stupid enough to start a war during the Hajj.
I would not jump to that conclusion. I think they would consider themselves clever for doing so.
Well, I mean that the
Do
idea.
Do not underestimate the stupidity of this administration.
Well, the idea of stranding Muslim pilgrims would be just inflammatory beyond belief.
Do not underestimate the stupidity of this administration.
Well, tell me about the six-front war then. Which are these? Iraq?
We've had two headlines, and really, you have the obvious Iraq. That's one. You have Korea. That's two. You have the radicalization of the non-Arab Muslim populations in the Philippines, Indonesia, and Malaysia, considerable population. That's three. You have India and Pakistan, as well as Afghanistan. That's four. You have Central Asia, which Turkmenistan is just turning into a real cesspool. And, of course, that's an oil-rich region as well. And then you have, you could even call it a seven-front war, but I've lumped them together, the Americas, where you have Colombia, the three-border region down in Paraguay, Argentina, and Brazil. And then, of course, you have these 30 cities in the United States, all of which have very active, organized, well-funded, well-equipped Islamic militant groups, all of which are surely going to be inspired to at least some suicidal terrorist acts if we invade Iraq as a unilateral power.
Well, you could also add, I suppose, the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, which...
Yes, you're absolutely right. I'm glad you mentioned that, because one of the points that Steve Emerson makes in his book is that Hamas, rather than Al-Qaeda, is the most immediate terrorist threat to America right now. And I agree with you. Not only do I think that Hamas has a number of suicidal volunteers ready to go in the Israeli-Palestinian immediate region, but Emerson documents how they've been actively recruiting American passport holders among the Islamic militants in the United States. And I would speculate that they have American passport holder suicidal volunteers ready to go around the world against predominantly Israeli and Jewish targets. But I think a lot of Americans could potentially die.
But Robert Davis Deal, isn't it clear that, at least if you take the Israeli-Palestinian situation and the North Korean situation as examples, that in the previous administration under Clinton, that by engaging these problems and trying to solve them and not by name-calling and kind of belligerence that seems to have been the trademark of the Bush administration, these things were contained. I mean, this is the thing that's extraordinary about this presidency. They are the wrecking crew, and they have divided America's allies, alienated them. Now, look at the Germans and the French. I mean, the idea...
You're absolutely right. I mean, the Rumsfeld calling the two primary powers, Germany and France, one of which, by the way, helped us get our independence from the British, calling them old Europe in such a disrespectful way tells me that that man is under serious stress and simply not thinking. And, of course, Nelson Mandela, one of the most respected people in the world, has pointed out that Bush is not thinking clearly. We have a serious problem here, and the American people need to understand that their best interests are not being looked after. Now, going back to your comment about the Clinton administration, I think I would give credit to both administrations. The Clinton people were good at talking, but didn't really follow up with decisive military action. The Bush people excel at throwing grenades, and you need a little of both. In fact, I think the president's biggest strategic failure has been not knowing when to stop. He's got Saddam Hussein right where I personally want him, covered by UN inspectors, and in fact, we did a press release yesterday that recommended a 2,500-person armed reconnaissance enforced by the United Nations, with U.S. squadrons on strip alert all the way around Iraq in case they were opposed. And today, by coincidence, the day after, Jessica Matthews, the president of the Carnegie Endowment, has an excellent article in the Post, which we've extracted and summarized in our headlines at OSS.net, calling for something similar. The bottom line here is that sensible people who are not driven by either ego or ideology have all agreed that we do not want to take the world to World War III. We do not want to gut the American economy and drive us into a depression. And we certainly don't want to destroy the United Nations, the multilateral peacekeeping and diplomacy that have gradually made negotiated pieces a new standard. So for all of this, I consider the Bush administration and I call them the frogs of war to be loose cannons who are not working in the best interest of the American people. And I think every American should be calling their congressman and senator and say, what the hell is going on here?
And in terms of the downside, it seems to me that that's what I was saying earlier about this disconnect in what the president was saying when he talked about Iraq having pre-delegated launch authority to chemical weapons, therefore proving that they have them. Well, that's a minor point compared to the fact that we in the 91 war, Saddam got deterrence because he said, if you come in after us into Baghdad, we'll loose chemical and bio on you. Now,
no, that's not correct. Please let me correct that.
Uh-huh.
The reason we didn't go into Baghdad was because that was the price that the senior Bush administration had to pay for the very strong coalition that included all of the Arabs. It was a precondition for that war,
uh-huh,
that we would not depose Saddam Hussein and that we would not go to Baghdad. And Bush Sr. honored that precondition. And Bush Jr. right now appears to be dumb enough to think that he can complete his father's work in opposition to all of the Arab nations. And, oh, by the way, the taxpayer should be outraged that at a time when we're running up a huge deficit, the Bush administration felt it could give $16 billion of the taxpayers' hard-earned money to the Turkish government in order to bribe it into letting 30,000 U.S. troops sit over there.
Well, if that's not the case, then Bush Sr. called for the people to rise up. They did, and they were hung out to dry. And Charles Delfer, who was the deputy inspector under Richard Butler, was the one that told me that they had pre-delegated launch authority, and that we knew that they could loose all of that stuff on the huge concentrations of coalition troops. But now we are going after Saddam. That's clearly he's the target. He's in the crosshairs. So what's to stop him from blowing up all the oil wells and letting loose these chemical and salvos?
Well, you know, we wouldn't be having this discussion if George Bush hadn't picked a fight.
Right, that's what I'm saying. Is this guy worth it? Is Saddam Hussein worth all this grief?
He's worth decapitating at some future date if he fails to yield to a very strong United Nations inspection force that will systematically, grid by grid, go over the country. He is absolutely not worth all of our troops being overseas right now. He is not worth, you know, what people don't seem to realize is the whole thing is unraveling. North Korea is confronting us in part because they recognize that we can't do anything about it. They have said that they will rain artillery on the city of Seoul in South Korea the minute our bombers take off toward North Korea. And, of course, they have people in position to tell them when they can do that, just as the Haitians had people watching the 82nd Airborne airplanes to tell when they were taking off. We seriously underestimate the intelligence capabilities of all of these so-called third world nations. Colombia is going to unravel. I think that here in the United States, if we persist with this Iraqi thing, we are literally giving these people a motivation for coming out of hiding and basically doing their death runs right here at home. So from my point of view, this administration has seriously destabilized the world. And I can't emphasize this enough. I mean, I'm the top reviewer on Amazon.com on all national security books. I'm ranked number 64 today, and that's competing with people who review videos and Pulp Fiction. And all of the reading I've done, all of the 330 books that I've reviewed in the last 3 years, all of them say that this Bush administration not only doesn't have a strategy, it is driving this world toward World War III, and that is a very scary thought.
And what is driving them, though? My analysis of it is that the DNA of not just the Bush administration, but the entire U.S. government, are born-again Christians, that they have
well,
this kind
no,
of...
Well, no, now, wait a minute. First off, I do agree with you that there are too many born-again Christians there in the sense that I believe in the separation of church and state, and I would be very uncomfortable with either a president or an attorney general that requires that I hold hands and say a prayer before every official government meeting. But no, let me tell you that I think that the military professionals and the intelligence professionals are people of deep integrity who are confusing loyalty to the administration and the president with common sense, and they are being repressed. You're starting to see more leaks. You're starting to see more clear signs that neither the Joint Chiefs of Staff nor the most senior intelligence professional analysts agree with the current administration's purveying of what they call the truth. In fact, our top headline today at OSS.net is from Admiral Owen, who is the former vice chairman of the chief of staff. And he comes out and says in no uncertain terms that this administration lacks a strategy, and the strategy or the actions they're pursuing are inimical to the stability of the world and the future security and prosperity of the United States of America.
And yet the juggernaut proceeds. And again, I would like to know what's driving it, because it's interesting that the most vocal critics of George W. Bush's strategy or lack thereof are his father and Schwarzkopf and Scowcroft. And I mean, nobody on the left has seemed to make much of a dent in it.
Well, I don't want to get into Napoleon complexes and C-plus loosely educated students. And there's an awful lot of psychology going on here. I think George W. Bush is inherently a good person who is in way over his head. I think he's surrounded by advisors like Paul Wolfowitz and Dick Cheney and Donald Rumsfeld that are positively detrimental to the best interests of your average American wage earner and small business owner and manager. These guys don't care about the rest of America. They have their own agenda. It's centered around oil. I do recommend Gore Vidal's book, Dreaming War. I recommend Steve Emerson's book, American Jihad. But more than anything, I recommend that every single American listening to this radio program call their congressman, call their senator, and say, come on, all stop, people. You do not have our authority to go to war. And by God, if you let this president go to war, then we should impeach him, because he is betraying the public trust.
And yet you feel that it's all going to go ahead. I mean, there's nothing that's going to stop them.
I honestly don't know. I think that there are some positive signs. When really mature people like Jessica Matthews and Norm Schwarzkopf and Bill Clinton and Nelson Mandela stand in opposition, when the Secretary General of the United Nations, who has really achieved extraordinary things on behalf of America's security, there is a slim possibility that if the American people wake up and remind their senators and congressmen who they work for, who elects them, that we can put this into a stop. And one last point. There are a lot of people that are saying that after all this, we can't pull back because American credibility would suffer. That's not right. Right now, American policy, as reflected by the Bush administration, is not only extremely troubling to the rest of the world, but we are being mocked for having idiots in charge and not doing anything about it. If we were to pull our troops back, have a very strong UN force in there, and set a one-year deadline, it would calm the whole world down. And we could then, in that 1 year, focus on wrapping up all these Pakistani and Hamas cells in the United States and restoring the integrity and the safety here in the homeland, which is what should have been, but has not been, the president's priority in the past year and 3 months.
Well, just one final question, Robert David Steele. When you say that there are cells over here ready to strike, either Hamas or Pakistani or whatever, why would these people need a war against Iraq as an excuse to get riled up and attack a soft target? I mean, don't they hate America to begin with? Aren't they here to do ill?
No, the short answer is no. In fact, one of the interesting things that we've found is a lot of these people are radicalized when they come over here to be students with the best of intentions, and then they end up just being pulled into things. It really boils down to preconditions and precipitance. And right now, the world is in a very shaky stage. These people have been getting money and cell phones and explosives and chemicals and all this other help from not just bin Laden, but it turns out that the United States is the second biggest source of money for terrorism after Saudi Arabia. It's raised right here. It's channeled into terrorism through all these nonprofit fronts. So Americans need to get smart. Their home front isn't safe, and they need to get the president to focus on homeland security rather than picking fights overseas.
I thank you very much for joining us in Los Angeles, Robert David Steele. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Hello again, I'm Ian Masters. I was just speaking there with Robert David Steele, who's a 25-year veteran of the national security community. He was the first CIA case officer assigned to counterterrorism, and he's the author of a couple of new books on intelligence spies and secrecy in an open world and the new craft of intelligence, personal, public, and political. And as he mentioned, he's also published his newsletter, OSS.net. I'm speaking now with Roger Morris, who served on the National Security Council under Presidents Johnson and Nixon, and is the author of a number of biographies on President Nixon and also a biography on Bill and Hillary Clinton, the Clintons and their America. And you're preparing a book now for Alfred Knopf, which I should be coming out quite soon, right, on the history of the United States involvement in both Pakistan and Afghanistan.
Yes, it's a history, Ian, of American covert involvement, principally in the arc of Southwest Asia and South Asia. It centers on Afghanistan, but there's also a good deal about Iran and Pakistan and of course Iraq.
Well, just today, India and Pakistan withdrew delegations of diplomats in a kind of upping the ante a little bit in terms of tension. These two nuclear-armed neighbors appeared to have backed away from the brink in the last few months, but apparently things are hotting up again. Do you have any sense of whether there's going to be another front opening up along with the forthcoming war against Iraq and possibly something in Korea? Do you think
I think that's one of the major dangers of this administration's policy, of the heedlessness of the whole enterprise, that of course it gives an opportunity to extremists in South Asia and in the Far East to make their moves. I wouldn't anticipate anything in Korea. I think the politics there are very different, but I certainly think that it gives impetus to elements on both sides of the line in the subcontinent, and as you know, that Pakistani government is extremely fragile. It's by no means unanimous, even in its own ranks, let alone the opposition outside, and the Indians are it's not reported often in the United States, but the Indians, of course, are fundamentally ruled by a similarly extremist Hindu faction. So I think yes, that's an extremely dangerous possible second or third front in the coming crisis here.
And what about our previous guest said that the ISI, the Inter Service Intelligence Agency of the Pakistani military, their sort of version of the CIA, are supposedly reactivating the Taliban? I mean, do you have any knowledge of that? Or?
You know, my sense is that we have once again created, perhaps never stopped creating, our own Frankenstein, our own monster. Absolutely, the ISI was a major beneficiary of the infusion of money and of sanction, in effect, that came after 9/11, came with this I think rather paper thin compliance of the Pakistani government with American policy, and the ISI is closer than ever to the CIA, and they're They're not only being given resources by the United States, they're being given the old laissez-passer that they were always given for what they were doing in both Afghanistan and in Kashmir. And
But it seems that, Roger, at a human level, the Pakistanis are getting the brunt of U.S. paranoia. At the same time, they're doing serious heavy lifting, because if the United States didn't have Pakistan, they wouldn't be able to deploy in Afghanistan. They'd have to do it through the Russian, logistical train from the north.
Yeah, and it adds to the irony of all of this, because the Pakistanis, as you know, have a permanent policy of keeping the Afghans as divided as possible and supporting those elements that are strong in Pakistan, to which they have a long-standing alliance, and that includes the old Taliban by obviously some new name now, by some new conglomerate that will form in Afghan politics. But the Pakistanis will be the silent partner of any long-term regime in Afghanistan, and of course the United States will tolerate that, will stand still for it.
But I'm thinking of the Western educated Pakistani international citizen who obviously is going to start feeling discriminated against and treated like a terrorist. I mean,
oh, absolutely. It's already happened. Of course, I mean we're doing that. We're doing that here. It's happening to a lesser degree in Europe, but at American insistence, it's happening all over the world. And there's no question about that. We're in the process, as usual, of quietly alienating the very people we should be encouraging and supporting, the people who are really working against our own long-term, or what should be our own long-term interests. But it simply goes back to how myopic and heedless this administration really is in its policy toward that part of the world. And there is no policy in Afghanistan. It's a catch-as-catch-can thing, very ad hoc. The resources are woefully inadequate. Secretary of State Powell talks about building roads to knit up the nation. It's going to be a very long pull, and I think will next to impossible to do for the United States in the long run.
Roger Morris, again, let me remind the audience, I'm speaking with Roger Morris, who served on the National Security Council under Presidents Johnson and Nixon as a biographer of President Nixon and wrote a biography of the Clintons and their America, is preparing a history of covert activities in Afghanistan and Pakistan. What's the title of the new book?
I think the working title at this point is A Policy So Foreign. There's a passage in the preface, which says, in effect, this was a policy so foreign that few Americans even noticed that it was going on. But it has the added meaning of being a policy so foreign to any American ideal or any stated principle of what America ought to be standing for in the world. It's a sad and I think very depressing tale of almost constant intervention and manipulation, low level, low intensity, covert action in South Asia and the Hindu Kush, in a country that we paid very little attention to, in which there was almost no expertise in the U.S. government, and yet in which we persistently meddled with often disastrous consequences.
But turning to the war against Iraq, that's likely to ignite a lot of trouble around the world, at least according to our previous guest. What do you think is driving it? Because clearly, on the surface, assuming that the United States will be victorious, which they should be against just this thug with a group of bodyguards around him. I mean, I don't even understand why the United States has to go to war to get one man. They did it before in Panama. They went to war against a country which they largely occupied to begin with, just to get one man. They're going to war now to get one man. I mean, I don't understand. But it seems to me that on the surface, the reaction to an American victory, which may well be short-lived, because trying to put that country together and put out all the oil fires and decontaminate people who've been had chemical weapons lobbed on them, it will be perceived as largely as an Israeli American victory. And clearly the Israelis are the only ones that are going to win in the short term. They will neutralize by getting rid of Iraq. That further exposes Syria. That means that the Israelis can negotiate from strength, dictate settlements of the Golan Heights. The Palestinians will lose, the radicals will lose any support which Iraq provides, so that they will be dictated to. I mean, it seems to me, could this be the tail that's wagging the dog here? I mean, I can't believe the United States would fight a war at Israel's behest, but a lot of people in that part of the world will see it that way.
Well, I think it meets all of those aims and goals, and you know there are very strong elements inside the Bush administration who are decidedly radically pro-Israeli. You know, you've still got Richard Perle and that old in effect Jerusalem Tel Aviv lobby inside the councils of government. But I think the Iraqi policy is being driven, Ian, by a number of factors. It's one of those conjunctions in American foreign affairs. It certainly is serving the interests of the Israelis and people who dedicate themselves to that inside the U.S. government. It certainly is driven by oil politics and by resource and energy policy in general. It's driven by to some extent by the sheer fanaticism and political zealotry of the president and the people around him. The born again majority, as you've commented, that rules not just the White House but both houses of Congress, and there is of course the further complication here that you're absolutely right that we ought to be able to give an order to the Central Intelligence Agency to get rid of this guy without necessity of a major war. But you know, he's been in power effectively for a quarter century, even longer. He comes to power with the Ba'ath overthrow of Colonel Qassem in 1963, which is funded by the CIA. My book tells the story of Saddam's liaison with the agency handlers in Cairo when he's a Ba'ath party thug there. The agency overthrew the Qassem government, and as a quid pro quo with the new Ba'ath rulers, gave them handwritten lists of Iraqi communists who then were exterminated, some by Saddam himself, executions carried out at one of his famous prisons. He's been there for a very long time. This is a regime that is not simply one man, but it's tribally and clan-based. There are a lot of people in Iraq who owe their careers, their power, their prestige, their wealth, everything to that regime. So getting rid of him is not a simple matter, and even if we were to get rid of him, there's no guarantee that another regime in that same mold wouldn't take his place. So in a sense, the administration is facing the need for an all-out victory here, an occupation of Baghdad, some kind of elimination, probably physical, of literally hundreds, if not thousands, of loyalists to the government, and the installation of an American puppet from the outside.
So just to recap some of that stuff that's in your new book about how the CIA had a relationship with Saddam going back to the time that he was living in exile in Cairo, and they helped engineer the coup that brought him into power, and then handed him lists of communists that they wanted executed. And Saddam, of course, is apparently a fairly practiced psycho, in a murderer. I mean, he's personally murdered a lot of people, apparently.
Yeah, he was an enforcer for the party. I mean, you know, there was an attempt on Qassem's life. Qassem is the Iraqi officer who led the coup in 1958, overthrowing the king, right, and Nuri Assad. You know, the original overthrow of the Baghdad Pact. And Qasim was, was an independent force in the Arab world, wanted to restore Iraqi greatness, and was the first to nationalize the oil and to chase the British out, and he became a target for the agency during the Kennedy administration.
But I'm surprised, though, that Qaddafi. I'm sure that's true that the agency gave Saddam and his cronies a list of people to execute communists, and they did it. But how come Saddam's role model is Joseph Stalin if he kills communists? You know,
I'm not really sure that isn't partly myth. Ian. Uh-huh. I mean, this is a shrewd and cunning and ruthless Iraqi politician, but he's of a kind, he's of a mold that's pretty familiar. I think that you haven't had a peaceful change of power in Iraq since the 1930s, the British were the first to use poison gas against the Kurds and the RAF in the 1930s, putting down rebellions in the north. Much of what's attributed to Saddam Hussein, I think, is somewhat overblown. He's in a tradition of Iraqi politics, and I'm not sure about the Stalin the Stalin worship.
Well, just fill me in on the British using poison gas in the 30s against Kurdish tribes.
The British were putting down rebellions of the Kurds. The Kurdish rebellion, of course, goes back to the 1920s when Iraq is sort of stitched together, out of the Ottoman Empire, and there were three distinct areas because of the discovery of petroleum that the British fashioned into this artificial country, the Shiite South and the Baghdad Center, and then the Kurdish North, and the Kurds had begun armed revolts as early as 1930, and the British dropped gas canisters and strafed and bombed Kurdish settlements and concentrations of rebels in the mid-1930s.
Well, that's an extraordinary little detail of history that I hadn't heard.
Saddam Hussein is not the first. I mean, it takes nothing away from his ruthlessness or savagery, but he's not the first to use chemical weapons in Iraq or in the Middle East, and he is he's scarcely the most brutal ruler that we've witnessed in the last 50 years.
Well, which is why you wonder why they want to, if our previous guest is right, they want to start World War III just to get rid of this guy.
Well, I think he's certainly seen as a major threat to not just to American dominance, but of course to our clients in the area. I mean, this is the first Arab leader, after all, to consciously and deliberately set out to acquire an arsenal that really rivals Israel's. This is the first genuinely Arab, not the first Islamic bomb, but the first Arab bomb. And I think the overall threat to American hegemony in the Middle East is seen as quite real in Washington. And the Saudis are the shadow here. I do think that the overthrow of the Iraqi regime and the general chaos that will follow in various quarters it will have its repercussions in Saudi Arabia as well. That regime's days are numbered, and I think that's even a perception in Washington that the Saudis are short term, and that we're going to need a puppet regime in Iraq for the oil and for the general stability of the area.
So, ironically, the day that the United States troops arrived in Saudi Arabia was the beginning of the end, and I remember at the time a lot of people, including some Russian analysts, who lay down that scenario, and of course that's been the motivation for bin Laden, is to get the U.S. troops out of there. And there's some indications that the U.S. conned the Saudis into getting in there in the first place, even though the infrastructure was always there with all these bases that were built by, Bechtel and all these, and Fluor and Halliburton, etc. The bottom line is that when Saddam invaded Kuwait, and there was some ambiguity over the way the Americans sort of gave him an amber light, or they, at least they didn't, the famous April Glaspie discussion where they didn't make, they didn't seem to think that it bothered them too much one way or the other. But then when, apparently when the US convinced the Saudis that they were next, that is when they let them in. And it's been nothing but grief since then, and that regime has clearly, you know, has no legitimacy in the eyes of the Muslim world if they're the custodians of the holy shrines. And
well, I think it, you know, I think it hastened what was going to be a decline and fall of that regime anyway, because of its corruption and because of the eventual dropping out, as it were, of the bottom there economically. I mean, per capita income has dropped drastically. The boom times are over for Saudi Arabia, and there's been an enormous waste and squandering of resources with that corruption. And so that regime's days, I think, were always numbered, but we certainly hastened its decline and fall, and I think obviously strengthened a radical Islamic element with the occupation.
So the idea is then to cut Saudi Arabia loose and have a permanent U.S. military presence in Iraq. Which
I think the Saudis are in the long term are quite expendable, and I think that's one of the ulterior motives driving this policy. And I don't know how thoughtful the Bush administration is at its upper echelons. I doubt very thoughtful at all. But I certainly think there are Pentagon and CIA planners who are looking at the long term stability of the region and reckoning that the Saudis are a weak reed.
Well, I just can't believe that this imposing democracy on this artificial country that was cobbled together by the British colonial map makers. There's a Shia majority there. It would seem to be obvious that Iran will be the beneficiary. And I'm sure the Iranians are sort of smiling to themselves and saying to the Americans, welcome to the neighborhood, boys.
Well, it will. It will benefit our old enemy here, our old rival. Which is of course the pattern in American policy, where there really are just sort of permanent interests, no permanent friends here for Washington and the region, certainly no permanent ideals. But it will not be a democratic regime, of course, because they'll have to keep it cobbled together. They'll have to hold the Kurds in line, and there will have to be some accommodation with the Sunnis and the Shiites. I mean, it will be an Iranian dominated regime, but that means this subordination, this subjection, really of this very sizable Sunni faction that has been running the government and certainly runs the army now and the administrative structure. And there's another element of this. Almost every major opposition group that we're openly aligned with. I mean, meeting for teleconferences with Cheney and all the rest over the last 6 to 8 months. Are fundamentally reactionary forces. These are elements that were much less progressive on women's issues and social issues, land redistribution, and all the rest than Saddam Hussein. I mean, we mustn't ever forget that this very savage radical tyrant who has concentrated power in his hands and deals with his would-be opponents in a very brutal way was also fundamentally a socialist. The old Ba'ath Party really did bring Iraq that existed before the Persian Gulf War was one of the more progressive and rapidly developing states in the Middle East, and it always rivaled the Egyptians.
And it was always the most secular, wasn't it?
Yes,
it was in
a curious way, of course, one of the most powerful secular alternatives to the rising tide of Islamic radicalism and anti-American fundamentalism in the region. So getting rid of Saddam here and installing the present array of opposition outside the country is going to be a decidedly mixed blessing. If you think the war is problematical, wait for the peace.
Well, it seems though I can't believe that anybody thinks it's worth it, and the Europeans are coming up with a plan, the Germans and the French, to expand the inspections and contain the guy. I mean, clearly, he's just a run-of-the-mill thug, and if you put the possession of weapons of mass destruction make him something that he's not, and I'm sure that's who he is. I mean, I think the guy definitely his identity is tied up in the possession of weapons of mass destruction, isn't it?
Absolutely, and he represents a challenge to American power, which is a powerful and no doubt infectious example for the rest of the region. So he's almost got to be slapped down here and made an example of, because and he's 66 years old. He's not going to live forever, but a successor regime. And I would bet that there's a good chance that it will be controlled by much the same. If we simply let him die, or even if we assassinated him, that the new regime would be a genuine successor regime. Would be of the same people and same forces, with the same arsenal. He represents a threat to perceived American interest. But
if you pick a fight with this guy, he's going to use all of these weapons, isn't he? And isn't he going to blow up the oil as well? I mean,
it's like the North Koreans in that sense, Ian. I mean, he doesn't. The weapons will not be used as long as they can be employed for political posturing in the long run. But there's no reason, if it's Gadamerong, if he's about to go down, there really is no reason. And with people, the people around him will perceive that too, that their lives are in danger. His commanders, the people who have been running this regime, are not going to survive a takeover by the Americans. And by the installation of a puppet government, there will be a blood vengeance in Iraq, and they know that. This happened in 1963, and it happened again when Saddam took over, of course, more decisively in 1979. There are a lot of people, including his field commanders, the people who have their hands on the trigger, as it were, who have no incentive here to use everything they've got.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us in Los Angeles, Roger Morris, and I'll stay in touch. And when's your book coming out?
It should be in the summer, but I don't have a pub date yet. It's a much expanded book beyond its original scope of just covering American policy in Afghanistan.
Well, the stuff that you've just some of the little tidbits that you've given us are fascinating, and I look forward.
Well, the Iraqi story is equally bleak, of course. So, well, nice talking to you, Ian.
Thank you. Bye bye. Hello again, I'm Ian Masters. I've just been there with Roger Morris, who served on the National Security Council under Presidents Johnson and Nixon. Bye for now.